Welcome to another episode of Girls on Film, a podcast where ladies talk about movies. Tonight we have the press conference from the upcoming release of Rosewater. The feature film Rosewater is based on the New York Times bestselling memoir, Then They Came For Me, a family story of love, captivity, and survival, written by the BBC journalist Maziar Bahari. A true story, the film marks the screenwriting and directorial debut of The Daily Show host and executive producer, Jon Stewart, and stars Gael Garcia Bernal, leading an international cast. Rosewater follows the Tehran-born Bahari, a 42-year-old broadcast journalist with Canadian citizenship living in London. In June 2009, Bahari returned to Iran to interview Mousavi, who was the prime challenger to controversial incumbent president Ahmadinejad. As Mousavi's supporters rose up to protest Ahmadinejad's victory declaration hours before the polls closed on election day, Bahari endured great personal risk by submitting camera footage of the unfolding street riots to the BBC. Bahari was soon arrested by the Revolutionary Guard Police, led by a man identifying himself only as Rosewater, who proceeded to torture and interrogate the journalist over the next 118 days. Take a listen to the press conference, and we'll be right back with you.
Good afternoon. Here we are. Question for both of you. It has to do with the publications that came out for the last 4 years. I know you did the adaptation on his last 2014 edition version of Rosewater. But there were three other publications that came out with a variational difference in titles, yes.
Oh, okay.
And I believe Amy Molloy is credited with...
No, it's the same book. It's the same book.
Yeah, yes, they're
just same on
book.
In, yeah, just different paperback.
Right. Yeah, but with no changes.
No.
Okay.
So what happened basically was that when I came out of prison, I went on the Daily Show. And first of all, when I came out of prison, I wrote 50,000 words, and then out of that came the Newsweek story, then I went on the Daily Show,
right.
We became friendly, and then we talked about doing a film. John wanted to be the producer of the film, and we approached different people. John talked to some people, I talked to some people, and people were busy or were doing... we're not interested.
Being paid to write.
Yeah.
As opposed to what we were going to do.
Exactly. And I think after a year and a half, John just said that, we cannot wait and we have, it has to be done. So he started to write the script and we collaborated on the script. And it's the same book. It's not
right.
And J.J. Abrams, did he have something to do with that?
There were, obviously on the show we had a few directors that had come on, so I was like, I would sneak back into the green room and be like, "Sue." But it was they're friends of mine that were generous enough to read it, more to give me a sense of the viability of it, so that they could just look at it and say structurally, you got a viable project here, rather than sort of more specific notes or things like that.
Hi, I'm Robin with MovieHole.net, and I was wondering, were you nervous about making this film, John? Were you worried about what would happen to yourself and those involved when the Iranian government found out? If this is what they did to a press person, like, what would they do to a director who made a film about it?
I think he's going to keep it a secret. So
that's a good point. I'm nervous when the weather changes. Just in general, that's a general state of being. It's kind of a lifestyle that I've embraced. You can't control how people see your work or what their reaction to it is. And I learned a long time ago that you can't sort of try and outsmart crazy. So you do the best work you can do, and you do it with the most integrity you can do it, and you tell the story in its finest iteration, or that you hope you can. And hope that it's received in that way.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit about this.
I keep feeling like you guys are about to do a song. They hand the mic over and it's like, this is a little something from the band Toto.
Well, speaking of music, the music plays such an important role here, and I think it helps to keep the tone a little bit lighter, as does a lot of the humor. So I wonder how you went about choosing those moments where the humor was able to shine through,
so much of that is organic. You know, you can't impose that on the story. And I think that if you did, you know, the humor comes from the reality of how absurd the situation was. Maziero's not a spy. He hasn't done anything wrong. And so they've got to create this scenario that implicates him in some way. And there is an absurdity to this idea that, that regimes have a kind of a monopoly on the truth. So we tried to capture that, you know, because it's from the book. Maziero's ability to recognize that as he was being held was one of the most remarkable things about the memoir that he wrote. So trying to capture that in its natural state as opposed to imposing it upon the film was where I tried to go with it.
You're coming from all sides here.
Yeah, really.
Given, and this is a question for either or both of you, given that journalism is a somewhat endangered profession these days, is there any feeling that that you're trying to convey with this film that to make people appreciate more the importance of journalists and the risks that they sometimes take?
I think no question.
I think, as you say, journalism is going through a very difficult time in the history of journalism, especially professional journalism. But journalism, I think, is becoming more invigorated. Yes, professional journalists are having a more difficult time to get paid because citizen journalism is on the rise. And it's not only in this country, it's all around the world that citizen journalists are replacing professional journalists, and information is becoming more democratized. And I think what the film shows is this importance of citizen journalism all around the world. And I think one of my favorite shots in the film is the last one of that little boy filming the destruction of the satellite dishes, which shows these governments, they can create all these obstacles and barriers in the way of professional journalists. And then, you know, a little Mozart of citizen journalism comes along and films it and just puts it on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter and shows it to the world.
Hi. This is for John, and it kind of ties into the last question. Well, it's well known from The Daily Show that you have a complicated relationship with the 24-hour news cycle and cable news in particular. But this film shows a very euphoric or progressive approach to the social media news cycle as well as other communications in the 21st century. Could you talk about your opinions on that as well as how you wanted to showcase that as a filmmaker?
Well, I think it's important to, you know, you can be critical of things that you think are not holding up the ideal of what you might imagine journalism to be, but at the same time, it's important then to demonstrate what that ideal might be. And so this is, you know, the journalists are out there, because places are cutting back on the finances of journalists. Well, now a lot of them are out there without the infrastructure and support of these big news organizations. They're freelancing, and they're on their own. You know, even when you look at a case like James Foley, you know, this is a guy that he wasn't kidnapped by ISIS. He was kidnapped by locals, and they sold him to ISIS. You know, it's the type of situation that, you know, you are in great peril, and you don't know where it is. And it's all for the hope of capturing things that are happening in parts of the world that you think people should know about. And that's something that should be revered, protected, honored, and that's, you know, criticism comes from a feeling of disappointment in an ideal. And when you recognize that ideal, I think it's important also to highlight it and to celebrate it and to try and preserve it and to protect those who are risking so much to bring it.
From a different, coming from a different angle, this is your first feature, John?
I'm sorry?
It's your first feature?
Yes,
that you directed, right?
Yes,
wondered if, since that's the case, if you had, who you maybe, what you looked at, or maybe who you went to for some guidance or counsel?
Well, you know, I mean, the nice part about it was, you know, we assembled a team of really, that were expert in the craft of film, you know, from the cinematographer, Bobby Bukowski, all the way down to the editor, J. Rabinowitz, and I had Maziar's source material as the information, and Maziar himself as kind of the touchstone of the film. So it wasn't so much external inspiration as it was the assembled, the Avengers, if you will, that we had put together. That was influential in it.
I was going to do Springsteen people on the spot, so. No, that's not happening. but double back to when you were speaking about like finding out how viable the project was, I'm just curious about like, not so much, you know, J.J. Abrams, who, you know, would say like, be, you know, nice no matter what, but like, getting to like the level of Scott Rudin and people who would actually write a check, how quick was the process, and where was it like the guy from Big Daddy wants to make a serious movie?
It's interesting you say that. There was a lot of the guy from Big Daddy is here. I go to a restaurant, and the guy from Big Daddy wants a cheeseburger. I think part of, you know, obviously I think it helped that I had some profile, so that, you know, I think they could view it as a, you know, an added value to the project was that the director could go out and try and sell it in places. So you had that going for you. You had this incredibly compelling story. What also worked in our favor is we were doing it and assembling it outside of the, I think, traditional development of a film. So by the time I went to them looking for finance, I had a script. I had a time frame that I had to shoot it in, because there's only a certain amount of time that I could do being away from the show, so I knew very specifically when it had to be done. This is a script that it had, so they had clarity in terms of what their involvement would have to be, and I was only in L.A. for a weekend, so it was one of those where we sort of set it up through Scott and through an agent that he works with at UTA, send this to five or six independent financiers that you think might appreciate it or might take the material, and if they are interested, I'll meet with them that weekend when we're there. And so that's exactly how it went down. And by the end of that weekend, you know, we had our money and we had our time frame. And, you know, my experience in the process was you just always wanted to still be able to be in the game at each stage. We wanted to be able to write a script that was viable enough that we were still in the game. We wanted to be able to go and get enough money that we would still be in the game. You know, at each stage, you just want to keep it alive.
Hi, I too. The Daily Show correspondent character in the movie, how did that come about? Obviously, it was intentional.
Jason, he's actually on the show. Yeah. He's a real correspondent on the show and was the correspondent that interviewed Maziar, actual Maziar, in Tehran. So that was actually just a recreation of what had happened.
And did you cry when you first saw the movie for any reason? I cried twice.
I can tell you, I absolutely cried the first time I saw the movie. It was the rough assemblage. It was 3.5 hours long. I cried my eyes out. I was like, I can't believe I spent a year and a half making a giant piece of shit. So I was very upset. I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, it's honestly, the times that I probably cried the most were on set. There were a couple of moments on set that got to me. Watching it, you know, I've seen it 3,000 times, and so, and also, I don't suppose, but I know what it is. But yeah, there were some very, you know, very poignant, very emotional things that occurred, and also there was a lot of emotion in the process of making it, and gratitude towards the people that I know sacrificed an awful lot to be there to do it. You know, we got a lot of very experienced actors to work for no money in conditions that I'm sure were less than ideal than they were accustomed to. Shore Agdashlu is kind of the heart of the whole movie. She plays Maziar's mother. And, you know, this is an Oscar-nominated actress, and I'm asking her to come over there and, you know, run around in 100-degree weather during Ramadan for a couple of weeks for, you know, it was... The cast's belief in the story, the department head's belief in the story, created an environment that I was really grateful for. So that, I think a lot of my emotion from it comes from that experience.
And it, did it all kind of accumulate?
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. I wonder if you could talk about the aesthetics of the film. And in particular, you start out with something, oh, you know, there's rose water, rose petals. It's sensuous,
yeah.
Romantic, and then that doesn't, then
yeah.
You have the tension with
what? We wanted to sort of, the scent of rose water is something that, you know, is used in the mosque to kind of mask the perspiration of, you know, the devout. And so we just thought it would be a beautiful image to show the production of it, to show how it was made. But as I would watch it, the explicitness of it was kind of overwhelming. Like, it was very much, oh, I see, so something beautiful is ripped from its stem. Crushed and put into boiling water and put under pressure and heat, and then its essence is extracted from it. So what's your movie about? You know, it's that kind of person. It's so explicit. You know, knows that, I think. But fortunately, Mazer had put this beautiful poem by Shamlou at the front of his book, and it was the perfect antidote to cut the kind of explicit nature of that opening scene. So it exists now as sort of a background, and with Shore doing the poem in Farsi underneath it, it gives it just enough distance that it doesn't overwhelm you, that it's not so over the head.
John, have you been wanting to make a film for a while, or is this more of a case of a story that you happened upon that you felt needed to be told?
Exactly that, and completely stemming from Mazer and I, our relationship coming after he had been released, and the beauty of his memoir. I mean, that's really what it all stems from, and his ability to recall that and be generous enough to share that. It's not an easy thing, I think, for people to share, and luckily, I think, and Mazer would tell you, I think he finds it cathartic in some ways to be able to do it.
I just wanted to know from both of you, Iranian culture and politics are really at the heart of this film. How were you guys able to replicate that while shooting in Jordan?
Oh, I'm Iranian. So I grew up in Iran, and I had worked in Iran for 12 years after I went back to Iran as a filmmaker, as a journalist. So I knew the culture. I had, I studied Iranian politics, history. I know the literature, film, and we worked together on the script, so and John was open to suggestions and collaboration, and also I was on the set, so I was giving advice on that, and we were also lucky that some of our friends in Iran, they sent us some footage from Iran in order to show the POVs, all the point of view shots, they're all from Iran, their original footage for this film.
But it does also embrace, a quiet inauthenticity. You know, originally, when Mazer and I first talked about it, I would say, I was a purist. I would say, this must be done in Farsi. And it must be done with a cast of actors who had all been imprisoned in Iran. And, Mazer would very calmly say, but don't you want people to see it? So that's, the decisions. I always kind of deferred. If he was okay, I was okay. And I had to embrace my own limitations. My ear is not tuned to that accent. So I had to create kind of a generalized palette that was not, this is not a Southie movie where everybody is just, it's a movie about how well someone can capture just that one particular accent. The idea was to create a template that could fade back and let the story come to the fore, and that was the general practice at every point in the movie. This is really interview karaoke.
This is for both of you. John, you've said that Mazer humanized the people who tortured him because if you view them as monsters, you can't fight them. My immediate thought was the hysterical cable news coverage of ISIS. So I'm curious what we can take from your story and this portrayal of it that we can apply to other demons that we fight.
My next movie is about Ebola.
Well, again, I mean, ISIS is another case that people are, it's supposed to be this monstrous giant that, you know, it's devil incarnate, and it's supposed to be, you know, something that you're going to end the Western civilization if it's not bombed to pieces. And I think it's a wrong approach. ISIS, Iranian regime, many corporations, you know, whatever institutions you're thinking about that are composed of people, these are composed of human beings, and human beings with their complexities, vulnerabilities, weaknesses, you know, good qualities. And for me, to start with, it was a selfish decision in order to humanize him, because I knew that I was fighting him on two different fronts. One was a physical battle that I knew I had lost from the beginning. I was a prisoner, I had the blindfold on, and he was stronger than me. But the other battle was the psychological battle that I had with him. And I knew I could be a winner because I had lived a richer life, I was more cultured than him, I was more open to ideas. So in order to take advantage of that superiority, I had to humanize him. If he was a monster, if he could not be manipulated, you know, I was going to lose that psychological battle as well. So the massage scenes that you see in the film, even though they're funny, it came from that point of view, that I recognize, okay, this guy is an employee, you know, he's working. He could be a dentist, he could be a, you know, an accountant, he could be a bookkeeper, whatever. He had a boss, so he had to give something to his boss. But at the same time, he has a wife, he cannot see his wife, he spends all this time in dark rooms beating people, insulting people, and, you know, he's horny. He's just, you know, I had to give him something in order to satisfy him. So, based on all these, you know, calculations, which, you know, it didn't happen like that, you know, it just happened in a moment of inspiration, I started the massage stories, and, of course, in the book, you have many more massage stories. That's all the film would have, yeah.
Actually, tail end of that question, how far in before you felt comfortable enough, as comfortable as you could be, to inject that humor and humanize him?
I humanized him, let's say, from the beginning, but it was difficult to assess the situation, because when they put me into interrogation room on the first day and they charged me with spying for four different intelligence agencies, I was just shocked. I didn't know what to do. So it took me a while. I'm not sure how long did it take to do that, but it took me a while to, you know, to find out how can I behave. But what happened was that they wanted me to name names in the beginning, and they wanted me to implicate people by fabricating stories, and they were encouraging me to fabricate stories about different people. And after a while, when they realized I was not going to do that, they delved into my personal life and, you know, sex life, and they wanted me to write those kind of testimonies in order to implicate me through, because they wanted me to portray me as corrupter of the earth, which is, I mean, we laugh about it, but it is punishable by death in, you know, Iran. So I had to come up with a way that, you know, okay, I was corrupting the earth, but at the same time, I was not corrupting it that much. I did not have a relationship with this woman. There was no penetration as such. Because according to Islamic law, you have to penetrate in order to... I'm giving you too much information. In order to sentence you to death. So I had to come up with these ridiculous massage stories in order to, you know, be sentenced, but not sentenced to death. Maybe 74 lashes. Okay.
This is more for you in a more broad sense about you deal with injustices, this movie, other things that you do. How are you able to keep your sense of humor and bring that into the things that you do?
Do you know, you ever hear something, it's Xanax, it's called? Someone to take it with water at night. And it's very helpful. You know, it's not so much how do you retain your sense of humor, but that is the map. It's like saying, you know, you eat a lot of meat, how do you keep digesting it? Like, it is the enzyme that I use to process these events. And I think that one of the things that appealed so much to me about Maziar is, you know, you imagine that you would retain that ability in under duress, but it's a hypothesis. And so to meet someone that is, you know, had the ability in that situation, you know, the canary in the coal mine, for him to be able to still maintain that, and not only to maintain it, but to be able to utilize it as his strength and as his way of defeating this was, you know, it's kind of an incredible real-life experiment.
Xanax-like.
Yeah, that is correct.
Last question?
This will be a more general question, but could you talk about the process of casting a guy? You initially wouldn't think of he would be the perfect choice, but when you see his performance, there's no other actor could probably pull it off.
I think that's right. And, you know, I saw a lot of actors, and there was something, you know, this is a really dark story. And you have to play with the nuances. And I think occasionally, you know, actors tend to want to overemphasize that aspect of it. So you get a lot of wrenching auditions, and they were beautifully done, but they lacked the subtlety and agility. The thing about Gael that he had from the first audition was agility. And I take it to, so if you remember, there's one scene where Maziar is being told to call his wife for the first time. So in the room, he goes from terror, because the interrogator has told him to stand up, to incredulity that he's going to get a chance to call his wife, to unbridled joy at finding out he's having a baby girl, to getting the shit kicked out of him, to laughing in his face. And that all takes place in 2.5 minutes. And an ability for an actor to do that with grace and without drawing attention to his own craft is unheard of. And I felt like Gael was the one guy who had captured that ability. Even within the audition, he had glimmers of Maziar's mischief while still doing scenes of real duress. And so it was, for me, a very clear choice.
Might as well get a picture of you guys together to go along with everything.
It's hard with the microphone.
Should we come down there? Is it better to?
Yeah, I feel like they want you by all means.
Well, you need to, yeah. Sure.
Are you guys come up here?
I'll carry you down.
What would be better? Because I feel like all the shots look weird.
We've been a stage guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Over here.
Sorry.
Yeah, this way. Is this better over here? Maybe right up here. This way.
Stewart's debut is truly impressive. The film is visually stunning and incredibly personal. No matter what side of the aisle you sit on, Rosewater will resonate with you deeply. Thanks for listening to this episode of Girls on Film. Many thanks, as always, to producer Melissa Hansen. Rosewater opens November 14th. I'm your host, Liz Whittemore, and until next time, thanks for listening.
Quite.